Here we go. That's the smooth music. You know what? It's a lot smoother than me. That is the Golden Silvers with True Romance. And we are here tonight to have for another episode of Blind Squirrel Radio with my trusty sidekick, Kidge. Woo! Yeah. And my superhero, Robert Harrington. Well, I watched a great episode this week of Psych. Do you ever watch Psych? You've seen it, right, Kidge? Yeah. That's right. You're the reason I'm watching it. That is correct. Psych is a great show, but it's a detective show, and there are a lot of 80s references and stuff. And well, anyway, they just released some new episodes on Netflix, so I've been watching those. And they had a superhero one. It was pretty funny. And Oh, wow, I just hit a microphone with my hand like I'm an amateur. This is sport. Okay. They were Tap Man, and... what was the other guy? Oh, he was the Catch. That's right. He had on catcher gear. And so those are their superhero identities. Tap Man and the Catch. So Gus would do the tap dance and throw sand in your eye. That was his superpower. And the Catch could be kicked in the groin and not feel it. So that was his superpower. Because he had on the catcher's thing. Got it? Okay. Speaking of that, I went out to get... my daughter has a friend... If you hear kids in the background, my daughter has a friend staying over tonight. And I went out to their house. I live way out in the country. And I went out to their house to pick up her clothes. And I got out there, and they've got, like, three giant dogs like you do when you live in the country, right? And one of the... And they're real friendly and everything, and they know me, so they're not going to kill me and eat me. At least, I hope not. But I get out of the car, and, you know, I'm letting them smell me and petting them and, you know, let them get used to me before I go towards the house. And so I go to the house and everything's good. And on my way back to the car, one of them jumps on me and puts his massive paw right where you're not supposed to put a massive anything, okay? And doubled me over right there in the yard. And then the other two pretended to lick my ears. I was like, this is not good. I'm having a bad time here. Help me to the car. It was very embarrassing, and there was a woman there, and her husband wasn't there, and I know her, but, you know, what do you, it's like I'm doubled up in her yard, and she's like, I'm so sorry, I'm like, it's okay, just let me get to my car. That was the end of my story. I sat in the car for a couple of minutes, and then, I caught my breath and I drove away. I'm still not recovered. It's very upsetting. But I didn't come here to talk about that. No. I came here to talk about a church. And there's a fancy word for it, of course, because there's a fancy word for everything in this study, internal apologetics. And the $10 word tonight is ecclesiology, which simply means the study of church. It's church. Okay? We're not gonna get into... There's a word for everything. It's a word for everything. We're not gonna get into the... You can look up ecclesiology, if you'd like, on Wikipedia, and you can see all of the details of it and how complicated people try to make it. And let me tell you something. We're going to hit it simple. We're going to hit it head on. And we're going to look at the biblical mandate for church. What does the Bible say church is supposed to be? and they're broad topics, and you'll see how it works. Okay, so we'll just, you ready to jump in, guys? All right, let's hold our nose, and here we go. All right, we're going to look at Acts 2:42. Robert is feverishly looking this up because he probably hadn't had it. All right, well, we're going to look at Acts 2:42, which Acts 2:40 through 2:47 is sort of our text that we came up with a name for this, but this is like the reference text, where in context, this is the clear passage. And we'll talk about hermeneutics later on. But in hermeneutics, we always want to look at passages in context. That's the first rule of hermeneutics. And the second rule is to make sure that everything is in context. Okay. And then there's a third rule. And the third rule of hermeneutics is that you want to make sure that you're reading any passage you're reading in context. Okay. And technically, there is another principle, and that is that you would let the simpler passages define the less simple passages. In other words, things that are clearly stated define those that are not clearly stated. So if there's ambiguity in a text, you don't want to read into that in a way that would deny what a simpler text is stating. And that comes into play here as well, because there's plenty of places in the Bible where we see commandments of Christ, for instance. And we'll get into those in just a minute when we talk about what's not in the biblical mandate for church. But let's just work through this. So, Robert, you got that? Go ahead and read that. Go ahead and read 40 through 47. So this is, we're talking about the setting for this is Pentecost. And so this is the establishment of the church. This is where it became, you know, instead of it being 20 or 30 people, it became 3,000 people. It became the church. And this is the establishment of the church. So I wanted you to hear that so you could hear what in context where we're going to be getting our passage from. Go ahead, Robert. I'm sorry for interrupting. No, go ahead. Okay, so there you see the establishment of the church, and you hear the biblical mandate for kind of what the church was originally set up to do, and it's not far. We don't want to go far from what was originally established, and we can define those things. Of course, we can. Well, they have to work out into our culture. You know, we can't. In other words, we can't all come together anymore in one place. There's too many of us, right? They probably didn't come together all in one place even then with 3,000 people. There wasn't buildings that held 3,000 people unless you were going to the Colosseum. So, right. They would go to the Colosseum later, wouldn't they? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's look at that. So in Acts 2:42, we see the first of these. There's four mandates, biblical mandates for church. And the first one is fellowship. Sorry. The first one is fellowship. And then we have some scriptures that sort of define what that fellowship is. Let me do it this way. Let me go over the four in general, and then we'll go back and kind of dissect them. The four biblical mandates listed there in Acts 2:42 are fellowship, communion, a I just lost my place. I'm struggling tonight. Fellowship, communion, worship, and equipping. And those are all mentioned in one way or in one form or another there in Acts 2:42. It says they were devoted. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teachings. Okay, so that is equipping. And in another place in the Bible, it calls that equipping the saints. But devoting it to the apostles' teachings and what were they teaching? They were teaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. They were teaching what Jesus taught. That's exactly what they were teaching. So we have that. So we have the equipping and teaching doctrine. We have, and so we continue to read in 42. Verse 42 says that, and to fellowship, okay? And then to the breaking of the bread, which is communion, okay? And then the last one, and to prayer. And that includes worship. And we'll see in another passage that the worship sort of been broadened into worship, not just singularly to prayer. So let's go through this then. And when we talk about fellowship, when we look at other places in the Bible, as the church began to flesh itself out and Paul began to then minister to the churches, he became sort of an advisor as to what this fellowship of the saints is supposed to be about. And in many places, we see proper fellowship. In fact, 1 John 1, 6 and 7, Philippians 2, 1, Psalm 55, 14, Hebrews 10, 24 and 25. You want to read any of those that are really good there, Robert? Fellowship just to do anything. We're not supposed to get together to have food and talk about what color our drapes are. We're there to have fellowship in Christ. We're there to be loving Christ and there by enjoying that the love that God gives us with each other. And that bonds people together. I mean, there's no bond like doing a Bible study with somebody, right? I mean, if you're seeking God with other people, you'll make friends that you'll have for the rest of your life. Because, I was in a Bible study with that guy. Hold on a second, I'm going to go say hello to him. You haven't seen him in 2 years. Because you're in a Bible study together, you know, you got to go talk to him. And so that's proper fellowship. Now, there's also improper fellowship. In other words, there's some, Paul sort of got some rules about who you shouldn't include in this fellowship. Do you want to read 1 Corinthians 5? Well, 1 Corinthians 5 goes over, is the whole chapter is sort of about this event that happened. We don't want to bog ourselves down to read the entire chapter. Why don't you just do 2 Corinthians 6:14? I'm thinking, what did I mean by that? Why did I put that in there? Go ahead, kids. There you go. Now, a lot of people restrict this passage to only being about married couples, not being unequally yoked, but I think it applies to any trust relationship. Don't be in a trust relationship with an unbeliever, because he goes on to explain what fellowship does light have with darkness and what communion can evil have with good. So I think it goes beyond just the marriage relationship, although I think the marriage relationship is implicitly implied. You know what? It's talking about marriage there, but it's also going on to talk about any type of trust relationship. It's okay to be friendly. Okay? It's okay to be friendly to non-believers. It's okay to love non-believers and try to love them to the Lord and tell them about the Lord and share the gospel with them and listen to their problems. But don't enter into a trust relationship with that person. Do you understand what I mean by that? I mean, your best friends shouldn't be non-believers. Now, some non-believers may consider you their best friend, but your best friend, the person that you confide in, the person that you take advice from, should be believers. That's what that passage is. Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because so 1 Corinthians 5 is about this guy. He's writing to this church, and this church is boasting about the fact that there's a believer in their midst who is engaging in an obvious sin. They're engaged in a sexual relationship with their mother-in-law. Okay? And so, in the way things were looked at back then, that's about the same as being in a relationship with your mother. Okay? That's kind of the way it was. And that's the way they looked at it. I mean, that's right. And they were boasting about the fact that this person was that they had so much grace and so much love, and so they didn't judge, and they weren't judging people, and this person is one of our leaders, one of our deacons, that's how much we love, and Paul is correcting them and saying, no, you need to turn that person out in hopes that he will see his error of his ways and come back and turn him over to the devil and let him be in ruin, and he will, and because if you don't, then you're just going to enable him. Okay? Now, so we've got churches today that are doing that. They're boasting the fact that they accept homosexuals. Homosexuality is just a sin. But when you're saying that somebody's engaged in sin and you're going to promote them to a leadership position in the church, and then you're going to brag about that, that's exactly what Paul is talking about. An inappropriate relationship that you're bragging about. It's okay. Hey, it's okay if you're trying to encourage these people back to the Lord and to repentance, because we all need that, and we're all sinners, and not one sin is worse than another. But we don't want to then say your sin is okay, and in fact, we're going to let you be a leader of this church, because the Bible is very clear in other places about who should be a leader in the church, and those people need to be walking the walk. Those people need to be beyond reproach. So that's fellowship. The Bible has a lot to say about proper fellowship and how wonderful it is and how precious. Listen, there is no better friends in the world than two friends who are both seeking God. That's the kind of relationship that you want to pray for, that you have, whether you're a man or a woman. Pray for a best friend who is just as serious or maybe more serious than you are about seeking the Lord and on a daily basis, and you will find a friend there that there's just no other friend like them. But guard your fellowships, and be sure you're not entering into a fellowship with a non-believer or someone who has given themselves over to sin. Be very careful that you can still talk to them, you still be friendly to them, you still love them. Okay, I'm not saying you cut them out of your life, but be careful who you trust. Be careful who you're taking advice from, and who you're telling your secrets to. Or not secrets, but who you're confiding in. Okay, so let's move on to communion, the breaking of bread. It's mentioned in the Bible in several different places. This is the Lord's Supper, is what we're talking about here. Jesus took bread and he broke it, and he said, "This is my body." And he was talking to his disciples, and he was trying to explain to them and sort of what was going to be happening, and in a symbolic way. And he was saying, "I'm going to die. My body's going to be broken now, and you're going to be the beneficiaries of it. Take this and eat it." It was very confusing at the time, and it's really weird to think about it now. And then he took the wine. He said, "This is my blood that will be poured out for you. Drink it." And then he said something very interesting. He said, "Do this in remembrance of me." In other words, continue to do this. And when you do it, remember me. And remember what I've done. And so I think it's beautiful. I think it's great, because it not only is it just, it's not just a set of words. This is something that has been set down in an action that we all take place in, that we can take part in. And in that is the gospel message. You have Jesus giving up his life for our sins. Paul says if you're taking communion, you should do it seriously, soberly. It doesn't mean you can't do it in celebration of what's been done, but at the same time, you need to take it seriously. And you need to examine your own life and make sure that you sort of take a look and see that if there's any unrepentant sin in your life. You need to take care of that before you participate in communion. That's why Baptists only do it once a quarter, because they don't want to look at their lives every week. So, that was a joke. Everybody laughed at me. Yeah, there you go. Thank you. Yes, my church does it every week too. and I love it. But so you have the gospel message set out in actions. And I think that's just awesome. I just think it's incredible, and it's so important for the church to participate in this. And now that I am a part of the church that does this on a weekly basis, it just makes such a big difference. And I don't think I could ever go back to a church that didn't do it on a weekly basis. But it's done in very different ways, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes the reasons why it's done in different ways are a little confusing to me, but sometimes in churches, you pass the plate, and the kids always love to learn this, because a lot of the kids have only been ever to one church in their entire life, right? And so they don't know that people do it differently. And it's because I have Baptists and Church of Christ and Catholics all in my class, we can discuss this and talk about the different ways that we do. We have Lutherans too. We talk about going to the well, it is, but we talk about the fact that the Catholics go down front and you get to stick your tongue out at the priest, and he places the cracker on your tongue and he pours the wine sort of in your mouth, and then the Baptists, they pass it down the aisles, and you take the cup and the little piece of cracker, and you wait, and you all do it together. And then in my church, we have little tables set up in the corners, and we all get up sort of casually and go towards those tables sort of randomly, and we take and eat and like as little miniature families go up there and do it that way, and all take our time and do it and set it down and come back, because we're a smaller church, so we can do that. And so there's different ways to do communion. Lutherans do it even a different way, and Lutherans have a rule where if you're not a member, they think communion should only be in the immediate local body, so they don't allow visitors to participate in their communion, whereas my church is open to everybody who's there. And so everybody does it kind of differently. Yes. Because Jesus had a gluten-free option too, of course. Yes, that's cool. Interesting. And that's the thing. We're all doing the same thing. We're remembering Christ's sacrifice. We all have different... We all do it a little different ways. We get up at different times. And we do it... It's passed out in different ways. But it's all the same action. And that's what we need to remember. That's what bonds us together. What Christ did for us. Not whether or not the priest puts it on our tongue, or whether or not we... you know, we take it ourselves, whether that's it's a little piece of cracker or a big loaf of bread. What we need to remember is that what Christ did for us, and we're one in that communion. Teached? That's a word. I'm backing you. Yeah. You learned it good, too. Right. It's both. It's very provident that you're supposed to examine yourself. You're supposed to examine to make sure you don't have unrepentant sin before you participate. But so it's a very private moment, but it's done in fellowship with each other. It's both. It's in communion. Communion indicates that that you're doing it with others. That's what the word communion means. It's eating together. And so you're doing both. You're corporately having a private moment. Isn't that awesome? Another thing I want to say is that if you're ever visiting a church and they're doing communion and you're not sure what the rules are and whether or not you should participate, just don't. There's no rule against not. It's not a sin not to do it. You can still, in your heart, have that time and that moment without participating in what the church is doing. So don't feel uncomfortable if you need to step back and just not, because there's no sin against it. There's no rule against it. Nobody should be looking down on you if you don't. Especially if you're a guest in their house. Okay, so let's move on to worship then. This is this is a touchy one for some people, but we're going to see if we can tiptoe our way through it here. Colossians 3:16. Okay, so right there, and we're gonna go ahead and read Ephesians 5:19 in just a second. But right there, we have the definitive passage. That is it. If anybody ever gets on to you for your worship style, just right there. Okay, I go by Colossians 3:16. So you do what you want to do. I mean, because right there you have hymns, spiritual songs. What matters is the end of that verse. Read it again there. Read the last passage. Oh, sorry. Well, I should have. There you go. With gratitude to the Lord for His grace. That's the only requirement for worship. It doesn't matter if you have a drum. And this is, again, I love talking to the kids about this because, man, worship styles are just all over the map. We've got Catholic and we've got Church of Christ. They don't even have music. They just sing a cappella, which if you've ever been to a service, it's beautiful to hear. Because there's no music to cover up, you know, because a lot of people just sing kind of, "There's a shine in my..." I don't know the words and I'm not paying attention. But when you're in a Catholic church and all you have is a cappella, man, you can tell when somebody's doing that. There's no organ to cover up somebody mumbling the words. So when you go there, man, it is crisp and it is beautiful and there's harmonies and melodies. And it's great. I love it. And then if you go to a Lutheran church, they got the big pipe organ going. And blah, blah, blah. It's very impressive. And you go to my church and there's a rock and roll band up there, you know. It's great. And I just went to the little church that is at our school we have our school at their campus. We went there this past weekend to give them a thank you card because it's Thanksgiving and the kids all made them a thank you card. And so we went there for service and I just enjoyed all they have is a piano and all they do is sing hymns and they have a piano, but they sing it with such joy in their heart. They're not... These aren't your old worn out hymns. I mean, they're pounding that piano like it's a carnival going on over there, and they're singing these 200 years old hymns like they just came out last week. It was just great, and as long as you've got that in your heart, then you're worshiping properly. And trust me, you can take any of those styles and not worship properly in your heart, and you can take any. And you can take any of those styles and worship properly in your heart. And you can take the worst worship song ever, which is Breathe. Can we all agree that Breathe is the worst worship song ever? Yeah. This is the air I breathe. You can worship, you can sing that song and worship properly. And you can take the best worship song ever written, which we all agree is Amazing Grace, and you can sing that one improperly without the right attitude in your heart. So, just remember, it's about the attitude in your heart towards the Lord that you can participate in worship. Oh, that could split it, y'all. Yeah. Oh, you can split a church that way so easily, yeah. That's not the way we do it. We're bringing the sacrifice of praise, right? We're bringing the sacrifice of praise. That said, it's also okay that if you don't, if a particular style of worship doesn't, is not favorable to the attitude of your heart, if a particular worship, if drums and rock and roll music don't really get your heart in the right place, it's perfectly fine to go somewhere else and find a worship style that does put you in the right place. The point is to worship God. And the reason why there's so many worship styles is because we all have different tastes. There's nothing. That's right. And so, you know. Right. No. Yeah, they were playing their Zippo lighter. Oh, my. So just remember that, you know, don't get bent out of shape about worship. It's about your heart, and it's about approaching God with that heart. Now, you know, a lot of people say, well, I don't want to be, I don't want to go to church. I just feel like they're entertaining me. I don't want to be entertained. I want to corporate worship. Well, that's fine. But some people aren't overcome by that. Some people can be sung at, and they can engage in that and enjoy those words and worship that way as well. So let's just not judge each other for how we worship and make sure that we have the right attitude in our heart and that we are worshiping properly. If we all do that, we'll be all right. Go ahead. Did you have Ephesians 5:19 ready? Robert? Mm-hmm. Go ahead. There you go. I mean, you can't criticize anybody else about what they're doing when this is what's going on. I mean, some people say, well, I don't like repetitive. That's not worshiping the Lord. If it's just the same chorus over and over and over again. Well, hello, the angels in heaven. it says in Revelation, the angels in heaven sing the... Well, they got one line. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. That's it. That's all they get to sing for eternity. So, if it's okay... If it's okay with God, then it's okay with your church if they want to sing the same chorus 10 times. Okay? It's not a sin. It is worship. And if you read some of those psalms, at the end of the psalm, it'll say repeat. It'll be like 5-10 lines and says repeat this 5 times. Hey, you know, there's nothing wrong with repeating it and just and trying to get into the words and really digging into the words and letting them sink into your heart. That's fine. But if you don't like repeating it and you want to sing a hymn and, you know, first verse, third verse, and fifth verse, let's go. That's fine too, okay? That's fine. Just don't be so judgmental of other people and how they're engaging the Lord as long as their heart... What does the passage say? As long as the heart is with thanksgiving and praise towards the Lord. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to equipping and we'll wrap this up. Ephesians 4:12, Kitch. And, okay, and Robert, you can do Romans. Okay, go ahead. Excellent. In Romans 12:5, we may have that. Okay. And 1 Corinthians 14:26. not all things be done for building up. Now, those passages in context say a lot more, but I don't think we need to go into all that. Well, the point of church is to equip the saints with the gospel for repentance of their sins, and also so that they can encounter the culture and tell people about Christ themselves. Now, this is where I want to spend just a couple of minutes talking about what when church enters into things it was not mandated to do. If we want to come together as a church and support a missionary, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. That is completely biblical. When we come together as a church and say we're going to be a mission, well, that's a little different. The biblical mandate for going and telling is on the individual, not the church. And when a church decides it's going to ignore equipping the saints in favor of, let's say, bringing the lost to itself, then it gets into a kind of sketchy territory biblically. I mean, there's really no mandate for that. Biblically, a church is supposed to be there for the saints, to equip the saints. Now, that doesn't mean it ignores the lost at all. It should be friendly. It should be loving. It should have fellowship. And I mean, it should have outreach in the community, doing things for the community. That's biblical. The church should come together and say, hey, we're going to go feed the poor. We're going to have a Thanksgiving dinner for the poor. That's all in the Bible. In the first passage we read in Acts 2:42, talking about selling and caring for the needs of the community that the church is in, and how that looks favorably on God and shows the glory of God and draws people to the gospel message. That's fine too, but the church as an entity, as an institution, should focus on these four things. And when it moves off these four things, it's sort of like when the government takes charity and says, we're going to do charity, then it becomes welfare. And it hurts the charity of the individual and of the church because the government is taking it over. And now it's welfare. And we all know that bad things happen. There are abuses happening there. And there's not that individual responsibility. And people who are receiving welfare, well, you know, I'm not taking charity. You know, I don't take charity. You know... Because there's a pride issue there, and there's like this thing like, if I'm going to pull my own bootstrap up and I'm going to work hard to make sure that I can feed myself and my family because I'm the, you know, because taking charity is means you have to swallow your own pride. It means you're getting help from somebody else, and you have to admit that. But when you take welfare from the government, there's not that same thing. There's no insult to. It's not the same anyway. It's not the same insult to your pride. And so, you know, the proper place for charity is with the church, biblically. And the proper place, so the same thing, when the church enters into areas that it shouldn't be in, and as an institution. Now, that's fine if it wants to support missions, if it wants to support groups to go out in the community, that's fine. Well, when they, I don't want to name names, but when a pastor stands in front of you and says, you people who say we should go deeper in the Word and that want more teaching, you know what? You're whiny. And this church exists to reach the lost, and that's the only reason it exists. Well, that's not true. We've seen here that the church exists for four primary reasons. It's the individuals in that church. The biblical mandate for the telling of the gospel to the lost people is on us as individuals, as believers. We come together in the church to learn how to do that, to learn the gospel so that we can go out and tell it. We come together for fellowship so that we can go out and love. And I think, so I don't want to get into too big of caught up in examples because I don't want to point the finger at people. I think it can become deformed, obscured, and but now that doesn't mean that focusing on preaching the gospel is wrong, because the gospel applies to the lost and the believer. We need to hear the gospel. We need to repent of our sin on a daily basis, just like the lost person does. So when you say I'm gonna focus on preaching the gospel instead of I'm focusing on reaching the lost, I'm focusing on preaching the gospel. Then you're reaching the lost and the Christian. And I think if we stay focused on the mandate that the Lord pointed out, the church will be better off. That's just my personal kind of caveat to this whole thing. But the Bible backs me up on this. There's four. And we see in our society today when the churches get off topic, when they change their their faith statement to a mission statement, then we start to see these sort of abuses happening. We see pastors standing up and saying, hey, shut up about you whiny Christians, or they talk about being spiritually bloated. You know what? You're so spiritually minded, you're no earthly good. Your job is to equip the saints and preach the gospel and then, encourage the saints to go get the lost. Yes? Encourage the saints to spread the news of the gospel. But I'm just saying that you need to be... When a church enters into area, and in history, churches entered into different things that weren't biblical mandated, like let's go save Jerusalem as a church, as an entity. And what happened there? I mean, we're still scarred with the Crusades, that was not glorifying God. The Crusades did not glorify God. So, making war as an entity is not part of our biblical mandate. Just like other things. So if we stick to these things and we realize that the personal mandate's on us and take personal responsibility for those things, I think the church as a whole will avoid a lot of trouble. Let's just say it that way. How's that?
Okay.
All right. Don't want to point fingers. I did want to talk about that. And all right, so that's all I have to offer. Do y'all have any more comments on these subjects before we close up? Well, I think we... I think that what happened was in the Great Depression, the burden on Christian charity was so great that it was welcomed when the government stepped up and had these social programs. And... Well, and then there was also we have to own up to this. There was also the abuse of racism in America, where we held a particular group of people down simply because of their race, and didn't allow them to or put artificial barriers in their way of success. And in doing that, we created sort of a ongoing poverty situation that then. That the government had to step in and help with that, or because Christian charity just wasn't able to meet that need, and it's because of sin every time. It's because of greed, Great Depression. It's because of hatred and racial, bigotry. In the other instance, that in those instances of national sin, okay. Then the man-made solution to those have now hung around our necks as burdens. And now we want to take the role of charity back, and it's too late. We can't get that genie back in the bottle, right? and so I think it's going to take another national crisis, and then hopefully the church will stand up and step up as it should and bring glory to God in a way that... That is good for society, and also puts the role of charity back into the hand where it belongs, with the individual and within the Christian community. Man, I talk too much. All right. I know. Yes. I'm sorry, Kidge. I talk too much, like I said. But thanks for joining us tonight, Kidge. We'll see you next... not next week. Wait, Wednesday? Yeah, next week. That's fine. We'll see you next week. Okay. It's not the hall. Bye. We're recording this on the outskirts of Thanksgiving, so it's kind of exciting. We were a little late. We tried to get away from Skype. We were going to try to do this on Google's tool, which is Google Hangouts, and Kidge wasn't able to get his laptop started. The crank broke or something, and so now that he's gone, I can say the thing. So we took a long time getting this show started, so Kidge just ran out of time to share with us an after chat. I only had one thing, and you had one thing. I found a great show on Netflix called Life. It's only two seasons, I think. It's like 24 episodes. And they canceled it because it was too good. You know, they can't have anything that's... Yeah. So... But I found the show. It's... the premise is great, and the execution is wonderful. It's about a guy who gets convicted. He's a cop, and he gets convicted of multiple homicide, which he didn't do. He was framed, and so it's kind of like this fugitive thing. But anyway, this all happens before the show ever starts. He gets sent to prison for life, and then DNA evidence, because he got sent to life before DNA was the thing. And then 10 years later, into his life sentence, the DNA, you know, what's that DNA program? Where they started trying to get people out of jail based on DNA. Anyway, there's a program. Clemency or something. Anyway, so this DNA project came along and cleared him. And so he got out, and then he got a settlement against the city. I think it's LA or whoever it was. I don't even know where it is. But he got it cleared. And I mean, he got a settlement, like, and nobody knows how much it is, but it's millions of dollars. And the other thing is, he got his job back. So now he's a multimillionaire. Nobody knows how rich he is, but he's very rich. But he's also still a cop, and of course, and he's been in prison for 10 years, so he doesn't know how a cell phone works, and he's got all the money in the world, and he hadn't had fruit in 10 years, so he's in love with eating fruit all the time. That's all he does is eat fruit. And so there's all these nuances that come out about, you know, in prison, the only way he survived was reading this book called Zen, you know, all about Zen. So he's very, you know, he's very quirky, and he's got all these Zen statements and stuff that freak everybody out. And so he's solving these murders, and of course, I like to watch shows that resolve every week. So every week there's a mystery that he solves. But there's also an overall story where he's trying to actually find the killers of this family that he was convicted for, because they never caught the guy. So now he's trying to find out, well, first of all, who actually killed this family, and then who framed him, because it's two different things. And the first season was about finding the killer. The second season's about finding who framed him. So, yeah, just two seasons. So it's kind of like Life on Mars. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, but you know what? Oh my gosh. So the very first episode is very funny, because he's got a Bentley, and he's driving around, like, and he's listening to these tapes about Zen, and he's like, I am not attached to this car. I'm not attached to this car. And at the end of the episode, he's got a friend who's his financial advisor, who he met in prison, because he was a white-collar criminal, you know. And so he's got his buddy, and they bought an orange grove, because he's in love with fruit, of course. And at the end of the episode, he backs over his Bentley with a giant tractor. Yeah, it's very quirky. It's very good. And the characters, it's full of characters that are very likable. There's his old ex-partner. You're kind of suspicious of him, but he turns out to be this really likable guy. And then... And so it's full of these little, and his partner, you don't know if you can trust her, because she's actually the daughter of a bad cop, I think. And anyway, all these people turn out to be very, even though they're very suspicious in the beginning, they one by one, you just sort of like them. And So it's very cool. It's very cool. I can't believe they. Yeah. Did you watch Life on Mars, the British? I mean the American version. Oh, we. It is, and this show reminds me of that show. They're completely different. Yes. Right. There's a sci-fi element to it because the guy's stuck in 1970, and he's from, you know, the aughts. You know, he's from modern day. And but he's stuck in the 70s. And what's really good about the show is how well they did the 70s. They didn't candy coat the 70s. People in the 70s are bigoted, and they really focus on how the sex was in the 70s, how sexist everybody was. That's what I'm trying to say, and how brutal the police, because they're in New York, and just kind of how you'll take the suspect in the back room and beat him up for 5 minutes, and everybody pretends not to know what's going on. Where, you know, he's like, he was a cop in the modern day times. He was a cop in 2000, and so you know, that's just unheard of for him, and he's trying to fit in, and he's trying to figure out, how did I get to this? Because he didn't do it on purpose. He's like, how did I get here? Why am I here? What's going on? Kinda, but not corny like that. There's really that's what's. He doesn't have a magical guide that comes with him. Yeah, he can't figure. So yeah, Life on Mars is worth watching. You should check that one out. And the reason they're just so well done, Life and then Life on Mars, they're both well done. Okay, so then you were going to talk about Black Friday. I would say that she, when we lived in Dallas, before we had Helen, I guess I'd say that she's gone through different stages. She's flirted with that and then abandoned it. Right now, no. She doesn't participate in Black Friday at all. That's ridiculous. That's just ridiculous. That's Thanksgiving. Yeah, that's Thanksgiving. I don't blame them. I wouldn't show up. Fire me. This, you know, a job at Target is not worth working on Thanksgiving. That's just... It's a greed thing. Come on. It's happened to me. We did it once. We got sucked into this, and Black Friday really. I guess it's really the last 10 years that it's really just gone crazy, right? Because it used to be you'd go out shopping on that Friday. That you just did it. You know, you went out and shop, but there wasn't this. It wasn't like a holiday within itself. It was just what you did. It was just a big shopping day, especially for women. They'd go out shopping. The men would go out hunting. That's what we did. Growing up, we'd go squirrel hunting. So anyway, when me and Faith got together before we had Helen, I think Helen was just a baby, And my parents were living in Dallas. We were here in Silver Springs. And so we decided to go over. We were going to be there for Thanksgiving anyway. We were going to spend the night. We'll get up the next morning, go early, and get some of these deals that we were, that, you know, hey, you know, a lot of stuff's really cheap, and they're really trying to get people in to buy it. So let's do this, you know. And my brother wanted a laptop. This is back when laptops were very expensive. And you couldn't get a laptop for $400. The cheapest laptop you could get is like $800. And they had some for $400, you know. And so... And we were like, wow, that's saving a lot of money. Let's do, you know. And so my dad said, well, I'll pay to carry a laptop. It's $400. So it's my brother. So we were like, okay, we'll go for you. You know, so we were going to go and get a laptop for ourselves, and we'll get a laptop for him, and my dad's going to pay for it, and blah, 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 blah. Okay, you got the whole, we got sucked in, right? And this was before it was midnight. I mean, this was 5 o'clock in the morning. We were going to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, go up there to Best Buy, which opened at like 6 in the morning or something like that. And we would, you know, go in and get a laptop. Well, we'd show up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Or we got up at 5 o'clock, got up there to about, you know, 5:25, something like that. And there's 300 people in line. And there's 3 laptops for $400, you know. Yeah. But you were saying, you know, getting duped. That's right. Well, here's the thing. We spent that whole day shopping, the whole morning shopping, and we didn't enjoy a bit of it. We were running around from store to store trying to figure out, getting mad because we got duped, getting mad because, you know, there was only 3, and, oh, you know, we were like, this is stupid. Christmas is to enjoy, and Thanksgiving is to enjoy. And so we're going to shop, and we may not get the hottest new thing this year. We'll get it next year. It'll be fine. There'll be 30,000 of them next year, you know? Well, yeah, it was like what, a year or two later, you could buy a $400 laptop at Walmart any day of the year. So it's like, you know what, we'll just take our time, it'll be fine, we don't have to have the hottest new thing. I'm not going to wait in line to get an iPhone. I'm not the kind of person that's going to sacrifice comfort for a material object. I've reached the point in my life where that's no longer me. Right. Your own ladder? To get your own ladder. I didn't either. Wait a minute. If I went and got the ladder at 5 o'clock in the morning, you better give it to me that day. Don't make me wait for Christmas. That's my ladder, by God. Oh, funny. Yeah, we don't do any of that anymore. We don't shop on Black Friday at all. I mean, we may do some stuff online, but that's about it. Yeah, there's that thing too, but we don't do that either. So it's nice, yeah. Yeah. Well, it was a big... Well, they did this last year where a couple of a different... Who was it? Like Michael's or something. They have this big thing where they were going to open at 10 o'clock on Thanksgiving night. And nobody showed, and it was like, you know, very, very low turnout, so they said they were never going to do that again. But now I guess Target's getting in the act, and they're trying to do it on Thanksgiving. That's great. That's just stupid. But you know what? I do most of my Christmas shopping is at Overstock.com or Amazon. But you do it. Overstock tells you how many's in stock. You order it, you'll get it. If it accepts your order, you get it. Now Amazon, sometimes you'll get stuck with this. Oh, this one's out of stock. Well, thanks for telling me 2 weeks before Christmas. But that's what I do. Now, what we'll do is then about a week or two before Christmas, we'll go over to the nice mall in Dallas, the North Park Mall, which is the big famous mall in Dallas. And sometimes we'll go to the Galleria too, because they have an ice skating rink. And we'll go over there and walk around and maybe do a little shopping, but there won't be like, it's not like we've got 50 things we have to buy. It may be two or three things that we're going to look at. We'll go to the Apple store, or we'll, just kind of walk around. But maybe we're just there to have some cookies and see Santa and enjoy the music. Because the North Park has, during that time of year on the weekends, they'll have an orchestra playing and they'll have a choir singing and they'll have, all these little events going on during the day. So it's kind of nice. Oh, yeah. It's very busy. That's why you don't want to go there to shop. You just want to go there and relax and have a cup of coffee. Those two things don't mix with you? I can't relax when there's a lot of people in the room. You don't go to the ball game? You don't go to the ball game? Does Robert not go to sporting events? You're right, you don't see the first of it. Well, that's the best. No, there's no baseball going on right now. No, not till April. Pitchers report in the end of February, I think. But you're a hunter. You like to get out by yourself and have solitary time. Right. I'm okay with not doing that. I like people. I like to be around people. Yeah. No, don't get me wrong. I mean, it's not that I don't ever like to be by myself, because I have a 2-hour commute, 2 days a week. So, I get all the me I can stand. You know what I'm saying? That's the other thing. There's something about me and traffic. It doesn't bother. It could be the worst traffic day ever. What am I doing? I'm sitting still in a comfortable chair with air conditioning and a Coke. I'm fine. When I say Coke, I mean Dr. Pepper. Sometimes I think I'm way more focused on my soda and what's going on my phone than I am the 70 miles an hour. I've often thought what it would be like to time travel and go back just 100 years and try to explain to these people who are riding around on horses what it's like to go down the road at 70 miles an hour in a car, in a modern car. It's just unbelievable. Well, my car's got 189. What? But they would say, "But isn't that dangerous? People would die." Well, yeah, people die. People die every day. There's probably 10, just in my state alone, there's probably 10 or 20 people die every day in a car wreck. I don't know if it's that high, but I'm just saying, people die in car wrecks. There. Yeah. Right. And then you're trying to explain You're trying to explain this to this cowboy. Well, y'all shouldn't do that then. That sounds like y'all are stupid. Well, yeah, I guess we are, but hey. You know, it's better than walking to Dallas. When you, see, you can get a horse with air conditioning, I might try it, but. All right, Robert, well, I guess that's about all. We've been on the line for quite a while. Oh, go enjoy. Well, thanks everybody for joining us, and be sure to tune in next week. I don't know what we'll talk about. We'll have something to share with you about equipping you with answers for your Christian walk, and also talk about something else that means nothing, like Black Friday. All right. Vayas con Dios, everyone.